hell does not allow its warrior children to roam unchecked. And so each is given their proper escort.
Oh, man, I love it.
Especially the jerk with his hat on backwards. That is sweet. Check his shorts. Bet they're brimming over. Oh, I so enjoy the shameful details. What do you think, Spawn?
Spawn?
Yeah, as in Hell Spawn. Hey, it's what you are, baby. So get used to it.
Oh, did I do this?
Instinct, sweetheart. You're a killer. Born and bred. You see violence, you act. It's a gift. That's why he picked you.
Whom? I can't remember anything. What's wrong with me?
Too long under the pan and booth by the look of it.
The following is intended only for mature audiences. Discretion advised.
So now, if you like, we can start talking about Spawn.
Okay, so we left off, what, at 23?
Mm-hmm.
This is the third part of The Hunt. Do we need to do a recap or just keep going?
We'll get to that. What did you think of the cover of 23?
I mean, it's one of the better covers.
He definitely got some good zombie
action. I never
really
liked that shoelace in the face thing, though.
It was distinctive, because, I mean, just being a rotting corpse maybe isn't as distinctive as one would like, but then again, he's got the great big green eyes. So I think that does the job. You don't necessarily need the shoelaces, but it was nice that they did acknowledge the damage for a period of time, at least. I still think it's Batman damage, so every issue after that's a slight Batman tie-in, so I can approve of that. Todd McFarlane, story and art. The issue is dedicated to Don Thompson. Do you know that?
Who's that?
Do you remember Comic Buyer's Guide?
Yeah.
Yeah, the newspaper, like the industry newspaper?
Yeah.
That's him.
Oh, okay.
He was a big part of fandom in the 70s. He, of course, was the guiding light behind CBG for the 80s and I think the late 70s before his wife took over after he died. I believe he died sometime around this dedication.
Dude, are you sure we haven't done this episode?
I don't think so.
This is sounding very familiar. You've told me this before.
Maybe so. I don't know. See, that's the thing. I thought that we might have, and then I couldn't find any recordings, though.
Okay. I'm pretty sure, because when I was reading this, I'm like, I've read this before already. So I blew through it super fast to review it. And I'm like, I remember reading this. I'm pretty sure we recorded
this. You might be
this.
Right. But just to be on the safe side, we'll give it a quick.
I would say 90% sure we recorded this shit. Because it sounds, well, that story you just told me almost word for word is the same story you told me last time when you were saying it.
What got me is I read this back in February because I read it with the intention of, you know what, maybe that's why I didn't see it. Did we record any episodes of Spawnometer while we were on the road during our road trip?
Road trip.
Because that had been my plan, was that I'd read Spawn 22.
No, we didn't record anything while we were on the road. No.
I recorded it. I had the notes in my phone, and then I thought that we might try to record while we were on the road, you know, because it's 4 hours in Dallas, and we didn't. And so I was like, did we do this? Did we not do this? And I tried to find recording somewhere, and I could not find it. So maybe there is a recording. We're just going to supplement it right quick. But I do have some additional information anyway to maybe expand upon it. The issue was released on August the 1st, 1994. Just to see where it's at in the timeline, at Marvel, the years-long clone saga had officially begun in the Spider-Man titles. The X-Men titles were mired in the Phalanx Covenant. DC was rocked by Zero Hour. The early abortion of the Schism crossover marked the end of Jim Shooter's Defiant comics. Violator had already been completed at this point and is acknowledged in the story by Tony Twist. Hellshock number 1 had come out. Wetworks number 2 had come out. Books that were around the 12-ish issue mark, including included Bloodstrike, Brigade, Savage Dragon, Stormwatch, Team Youngblood, and Wildcats. And then when you're talking about the need for recaps, they decided to just spend the entire first page with headshots and deep detailed recaps of who these characters are and what's going on with them, which is considerate, but it's also only a 4-issue story arc, so I'm not sure how desperately that was needed. I also like that they said that Jason Wynn is of the United States Security Group, and in the following issue they note that this is an omni-intelligence agency. So he's not just part of Central Intelligence, some bullshit abbreviation of the CIA. He's got his own separate thing where I guess he oversees all the intelligence agencies as part of the United States Security Group. Beyond the NSA, beyond the CIA, beyond the FBI, Jason Wynn.
I'll be honest. I figured you for a rumor. You know, ex-CIA killer turned ruthless mercenary. Little more than a skeleton on a respirator for almost 3 years. I mean, please.
The pain was cleansing.
How'd you come back from that?
The rumors you've heard about me are all true.
But you got no conscience. No soul when it comes to killing.
What I've got is a hungry bank account. And right now, someone's paying me top dollar on your behalf. So, what seems to be the problem?
You keep up with current events?
Only where death is concerned. Your men have had a bad week.
Yeah, well, I want the piece of shit responsible. Bring me his bones in one bag and his organs in another, okay?
Of course. But I'll be keeping the heart for myself.
For what?
Dinner.
Okay. Do we start out for, what's his name again? Overt Kill?
Yeah, they let us know that Overt Kill was destroyed by Spawn a few weeks ago, but he has clearly since been rebuilt. This is following the Youngblood story we covered a little while back.
Now, I guess you would say, he has kind of like an inhibitor chip in him, where they can have more control over him?
I don't get that impression. He seems like he's the same old, same old.
Well, no, because I think they, don't they program to see, like, attack everyone like it's Spawn? That's why he's attacking Terry?
No, I think it's because, I think it was Jason Wynn that got convinced that Terry Fitzgerald was Spawn.
Oh, that's right. You're right.
And then
right.
So that got filtered down to the Dawn, and then that got filtered down to Overkill.
That's true. You're right. I'm sorry. And so Overkill is trying to kill him. He's attacking him.
They're in one of the alleys in Spawn's general neighborhood.
This is going to be a slaughter. I mean, Terry has nothing on Overkill. He's slapping around. This little homeless woman sees what's going on, takes off running. At this point, Spawn has been confronted by Twitch and Burke about the crimes going on in the alleyway. They're telling him, don't move. He's basically telling him, no one can tell me what to do here. They want to arrest him because they think he's...
He kind of fucked them up with killing Billy Kincaid, and they only just got back on the street again. Plus, you got the whole missing weapons, which I'm wondering if they were going to touch on Spawn, because Spawn's missing weapons now, too. It's like his missing weapons, the missing
That's
weapons
true.
He stole
weapons,
are also
yeah,
missing.
Yeah, that were buried in the trash are all gone.
Him and Sam and Twitch are having a dick measuring contest, because he's like, you guys can't actually do anything to me, so you guys might as well fuck off. And they're like not like knowing what to do with this dude.
Yeah. Well, I mean, dude, you roll up on a guy in a costume standing there. You got to figure he smells bad, like decaying flesh. I've always wondered about that about Spawn, is if he smells like decaying flesh.
I think the costume locks in the flavor.
Like a pouch?
Yeah.
It's like a Hot Pocket.
It's a Ziploc, yeah.
So then when you take off his mask, dude, he's going to get that aroma of overcooked Al. The homeless lady comes running up and screaming for Al. There's a giant robot the size of a house beating up on this guy. And Spawn decides he's going to go, and they're trying to stop him. Twitch and Burke are trying to stop him, and they're yelling stop, and he's like, nothing's going to stop me. He takes off. Twitch shoots him through the knee, and they're just fascinated. He doesn't break stride. He's still running. It's like the bullet never even touched him. So they start chasing after him. For some reason, we're talking to Grandma and Wanda, and Grandma's talking about how great, you know, it is having the kids. But then Wanda gets a call because Terry was at home, and the FBI were there, but so were the mob. And there was a big gun battle in the yard. People are getting shot and killed. I believe the mobsters killed the FBI agents. Terry made a break for it. She's getting a call to come home.
Well, I think they're just establishing, because Terry, his whole thing is he's trying to save his wife and daughter, who he thinks the mob has got captured. That's the whole reason why he met Overkill in the alley. And so I guess they're just establishing where they actually are and just how deeply fucked Terry is that he's going to die over a bluff.
And so next we go to Jason Wynn, who really wants Terry. They've already put all this blame on him for the murder of the agents that were there. They see him as a spy. He's got the cards stacked against him. Next, we see Tony Twist. Who...
Oh, no, I'm sorry. That fellow is not Tony Twist. What are you talking about? That is clearly... what the fuck's that dude's name again? that's Vito Gravano. There's no Tony Twist here.
It's Tony Twist, though, right?
It's totally doing to us. What's funny, we're running out of material that the Spawn TV show adapted from the Spawn comic. And I've been really lazy about using audio clips, so this one's going to just be packed full of fucking audio clips because I was rewatching Spawn. And it's like, the dude is constantly called Tony Twist throughout the Spawn cartoon, so how the fuck are you going to try to pretend like you can fix that through your comic book reprints, you know? Yeah. It's like, no, this Tony Twist, he will always be Tony Twist. Fuck off with that shit.
True. Tony Twist is pissed because...
For starters, he points out, I've got enough problems already. You go back out there and make this go away, and I don't mean a little bit, I mean all of it, capiche? And then there's an asterisk saying that he's discussing the Violator miniseries.
Okay, so that was a really good, I remember that from the cartoon. Nice, man, nice. Now you're doing voices just like Mac. Great, bunch of fucking, it's a Q-Zoo in the fucking morning. Oh, fucking Lord. Voice acting and shit. Anyway, so we go back and Terry's getting his shit handed to him by Overkill. Man. Overkill's just beating the fuck out of him. And
he used to be a handsome
hero.
Man.
Huh?
He used to be a handsome man. He looks like shit right now.
Oh, dude. I got to give it to McFarlane, dude. He really drew that really well. Like that big knot on his head. Mm. That really bothered me.
Yeah.
I'm like, Jesus, that's a concussion. He's got brain trauma. There's that point where he slams him against the wall and there's this huge blood mark. Yeah. Now, he'd be dead from that.
Yeah.
Let's be honest. That's a mark of someone whose brains were splattered against a wall. And somehow Terry's still able to move. Spawn comes flying in, grabs Terry. Toupee spread, which was pretty nice looking. Overkill has this really freaky look like, hey! And Overkill, new power, eye laser, hits Spawn. I'm not sure if that would really hurt Spawn because it's science-based.
The cape protects him. It automatically protects him.
That's
so
true.
It didn't seem to do much of anything to him.
But, he hits him with a 2x4.
Right.
Come on, man. You got fucking chains, dude.
I know you're homeless, Al, but sometimes your attacks are low rent, man. Come on.
I remember seeing that and thinking, you might as well pick up a bottle. Just pick up a glass bottle and hit him in the head.
Well, it's like Sam and Twitch start shooting at the guy and it does jack shit. Well, no, so I'm sure the 2x4 is going to do the work.
At this point, Overkill is actually doing a badass job. He's beating the shit out of Spawn. Spawn doesn't seem to be able to get the upper hand. Twitch and Burke show up. Twitch is firing away. It looks like a done deal for Spawn. He's pretty knocked out. Wanda gets home in the next panel. There's news crews everywhere asking about what happened. She's freaking about Terry. She runs into the house. She looks at her neighbors. All their neighbors turn their backs on them. And they walk into their home. None of them would acknowledge what happened. No one's willing to speak up for Terry. Because at this point, we know that the mob has already got to them.
Not the mob, when?
Or the FBI, right?
The United States Security Group, I guess. Whatever the fuck.
Yeah. And so she's
This is kind of topical, too. Because, Wanda's far too late. Jason Wynn's men had already consulted with her neighbors. You see, Andrew and Karen Horn, these kind of generous people, are illegal aliens.
Against the whole family now.
An insurance adjuster for over 17 years, Chris Albrecht, led a fairly mundane life. For 3 years in the mid-70s, though, he didn't file his income tax forms. An audit at this time would ruin him. As for Anne Thumpolis, she has always been a pleasant neighbor, nice family too, but she has a skeleton in her closet. She had a child out of wedlock, a son, when she was 17. At present, he's in jail for car theft. His parole hearing is in 2 months. She's been promised his freedom. It's like, fuck!
Hey, so Wanda's in tears. You know, everyone has turned their back on them. Terry has the power to get up and push a dumpster right into Overkill from behind, and for some reason, it's able to knock over Overkill.
They just caught him off balance or something.
Yeah, but I mean, by all
signs, he's like leaning in to pound on.
Yeah, he's like a walking tank.
But he's like, it spawns on the ground. So you figure he's got all that weight that's unbalanced as he's going down to beat up on Spawn more.
He's a giant cyborg, man.
Okay.
Like with hydraulics. I'm thinking of like RoboCop 2.
I can accept the Hellspawn creature. I can accept the giant cyborg. It's the whole dumpster knocking of the cyborg thing that I'm going to get hung up on.
Absolutely, man. That's bullshit. Bullshit. Overkill throws Spawn and a Terry, and apparently Twitch is a sharpshooter as Overkill is literally, you hear like a big splotch sound where Overkill is smashing into Spawn, I guess turning him into paste, basically. He's able to fire a shot that goes into the ear and reprograms him?
Let's see. With uncanny accuracy, the bullet enters Overkill's body through a small opening in the ear cavity, interrupting the electric flow for a nanosecond. Twitch had hoped to cause some systemic disruption. The result was completely unexpected. The cyborg lumbers off. It has a new directive. And he just keeps repeating to himself over and over again,
Youngblood, bad rock, Youngblood, bad rock, bad rock.
There's a little asterisk saying, look for him in Youngblood number 7.
And so here we're left with Twitch and Burke looking over the broken bodies of Terry and Al.
Sam's
and
like, what a bloody mess. And Twitch is like, quite literally.
Yeah. You're definitely the Twitch of the group. So now we're going to issue 24.
Whoa, hold on. This is going to be two separate episodes. So.
Oh, okay, my bad.
Yeah. So what did you think of the issue?
I was okay. I mean, it's more punchy, punchy, kicky, kicky. We now know what's going on. There's all these forces outside of the control of Terry and Wanda. So their powers being flexed more. So now you're seeing how powerful Jason Wynn is. You're seeing how powerful Tony Twist is. And you got these big, powerful forces. And you got Terry stuck in the middle with his family with no hope of escape. And this unforeseen variable, which is Spawn, is popping in. It's a shit show.
Yeah. I would say that it's the best issue of the hunt so far. You really get a sense of this mounting tension. Things are getting worse and worse for Terry. It's seeming more and more likely that he's not going to make it out of this, that you're going to have some kind of big resolution as all these forces are finally converging on this one point. It's in Spawn's alley, and Spawn himself is overwhelmed. The only thing that really helps to break that tension is that Overkill is dealt with. We know that he's going to go off and be in another book, so that's one less thing to worry about, but so much of the damage has already been done that we don't know where it's going to go from here. So I do think it was a good writerly job of building mounting tension. So definitely a good issue.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it.
Wizard Series 3 card number 1 is the Chromium Series Violator, created by Todd McFarlane. Real name, Violator. Age, centuries old. Height, 3'4" in human form, which means he's shorter than Danny DeVito. Height, 11'2.5" in demon form. Weight, 203 pounds in human form, 725 pounds in demon form. First appearance, Spawn number 2. Origin. Though next to nothing is known about the creature that calls itself the Violator, what is known is that he is one of the 5 demonic creatures who call themselves the Flebiac Brothers. All of the brothers, Violator, Vacillator, Vindicator, Vaporizer, and Vandalizer, are denizens of the 8th Sphere of Hell and serve the demon lord who granted powers to the hero known as Spawn. Powers. Though the full extent of the Violator's powers are unknown, he has exhibited shape-shifting abilities, superhuman strength, and incredible stamina, and he has proven to be nearly indestructible.
No more clowning around! I'm not the Vindicator, or the Victimizer, or the Vaporizer, or the Vibrator. I'm the Violator!
We ready to mosey on to Violator?
Hold on. Let me bring it up real quick. Which Violator?
We're going to start with the first miniseries.
Which is which one?
There's only ever been 2 series ever called Violator.
Yeah. There's Violator versus Bedrock and Violator. Okay, so we're doing Violator.
Right.
So the first issue?
But before you get started on that, we're going to do the Violator miniseries, issues 1-3. The story is called The World, and the initial creative team is Alan Moore, Bart Sears, and Mark Pennington. So real quick, I found a Wizard profile from the February 1996 cover dated Wizard number 54. Gives a brief bio of Bart Sears. Born in Ithaca, New York, and raised in Syracuse. Got into comics at age 9 and made the most of the deal by visiting the store around the corner from his home. Quote, every Friday I would go around the corner to the local store and buy comics without covers for $24. I hoarded a lot of books that way. Comics gave way to an interest in, quote, film, animation, and things like that, which led to Sears being faced with a tough post-high school decision. Quote, I had to decide between the USC Film School, the challenge of the Art School for Film and Animation, and the Joe Kubert School of Cartoon and Graphic Art. The Kubert School was the only one of the 3 that did not require an essay to get in, so I took the lazy route. But I dropped out in my 2nd year. I was burned out. I couldn't raise a pencil to do diddly. Sears paid some nasty dues for 6 months moving furniture before working up samples that got him a short-lived gig at Marvel Comics, doing some stories for Savage Tales that never saw a print. Bart Sears had a cover interview for Wizard Magazine number 4, dated December 1991. He talks about how he got his start around 1987 at Hasbro.
Hi, this is Bart Sears. Actually, I started at Marvel. I just showed up the door one day, and Mike Carlin was nice enough to walk me around and introduce me to a bunch of editors. And I got an Iron Rose story from Larry Hama and a Sector's mini comic. I think Bob Budiansky, but I can't remember for sure. And my 2nd Iron Rose story, I realized how hard comics are to draw and flamed out. And then I went to Hasbro.
Designing the Cops toys and doing Fleetway quality covers, you know, like Stronium Dog, and I think he did some Judge Dredd. Did you ever get to see any of that stuff?
No, but I did watch Cops, and I did have a Cops toy, so.
If we're going to stop the crooks, us cops got to know who they are. That's the Rock Crusher. No jail can hold them. And here's Berserko, a dangerous street punk.
Meanwhile, at the crooks' hideout.
Look out for Long Arm. He's a tough street cop. Sergeant Mace, the SWAT team leader. And Bulletproof's a federal agent.
Give up, you crooks. You're surrounded by the cops.
Cops and crooks, each sold separately with gas.
Which top story did you have?
I think I had the one villain I had is the one where his chest would pop out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he had the purple suit. He
was the Cure, I believe I had the one.
I still got the one with the bazooka.
I think it was the one with the bazooka.
Okay. The cop?
Yeah, it was one of the. I had a cop and a villain, I remember.
Yeah, because I got them.
I always remember at school, we would do the gift swap.
Uh-huh.
And I got those for my Christmas gift swap.
I still have that toy.
Oh, shit.
I've got multiple cops toys. I fucking loved cops. I couldn't afford them, but thankfully my brother did. And when he lost all of our G.I. Joe size figures at camp, he gave me most of the E-Man size ones, which included some cops figures. But I actually bought a few of my own, even though they were pricier than I was usually willing to pay. Basically, they had the same articulation as G.I. Joe, but they were taller than Master of the Universe. Really well sculpted. You know, Bart Sears did the designs on a lot of them, and it shows. I'm a fan of Bart Sears' artwork and aesthetic, so I love the cops figures. I didn't really have much use for the TV show, and I don't think it was on at a time or on a network that was convenient for me, so I didn't get deep into the lore of cops or anything, but I love the toys.
How long were you at Hasbro? That was around 87, right?
I worked at Hasbro a year exactly to the day.
And you moved over to DC through the connections you made at Hasbro, correct? Through the cops line?
Yeah, DC was going to do the Cops comic, and I had designed the Cops toys. And the marketing guy, Kirk Bazigian, I believe is his name, was nice enough to let me go into the meeting. The DC editor was like, hey, this is pretty good stuff. You want to do comics? And I said, sure. So
I think the meeting, it was Doug Minch and Andy Helfer. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, Minch and Helfer.
Now, where was Heroes Alliance in that?
Hero Alliance. I think Hero Alliance was after Marvel, before DC, before Hasbro.
He moved to Pied Piper Prospect for his first published work on Hero Alliance. Quote, I stupidly took that book. That experience drove me out of comics, but I hooked up with Hasbro and ended up drawing G.I. Joe figures for a year. I started a family about that time and needed extra cash, so I started doing covers for TSR and a couple of Conan portfolios.
Yeah.
So you didn't do any work for them while you were at Hasbro?
No. No. Again, comics was just too much for me in the early days. I just wasn't prepared to make deadlines. It was too much work. And a year at Hasbro taught me how to produce work on schedule.
I was introduced to Bart Sears through Exo Manowar.
Shit, you relate to the game then. Let me give you a little bit more back history then. He did Hero Alliance for Wonder Color, and then eventually went over to Innovation as well. Did you get to see any of those books?
Which one?
Hero Alliance?
Nope.
He quit Hasbro, and it turns out, even though you wouldn't expect it, comics were actually more lucrative than toy design, at least as a staff job.
Oh, wow.
So he almost took over the Spectre after playing around with the cops doing covers and stuff, and he also was going to be on a Creeper book that got aborted, so I'm assuming that was probably going to be one that Keith Giffen was going to do at one point, but none of those came to pass. Instead, he got roped into finishing the Invasion event in 1988. Do you remember Invasion?
Yes, I do remember. In DC, right?
Yep. Well, you remember who started the Invasion miniseries?
No.
Todd McFarlane.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so McFarlane did two of the 380-page giant issues. Bart Sears did the last one, and of course, one of our buddies, Siskoid, actually did a whole podcast about Invasion. It lasted, I don't know, 30, 40 some odd episodes, just covering the entire event with his buddy Bass.
Did you leave Justice League Europe to do the last part of Invasion? Is that how that worked? Or was that for the Legends of the Dark Knight story?
Legends of the Dark Knight. Invasion was first. That led to Justice League Europe.
So after Invasion, Bart Sears launched the Justice League Europe series. He did that book over Keith Giffen's layouts, but one of his regrets was he never got to go to Europe and he didn't have any good reference for it. And our buddy Shag actually does a podcast about Justice League International that's now covering Justice League Europe. He talks about how it seems like every issue manages to get the Eiffel Tower in there somewhere, because that's one of the only ways you could tell that they're in Paris.
Oh, wow.
So that led to Justice League Europe, correct?
Yes, yep.
And you spend a couple of years there?
Better part of three, I think.
Did you have any particular affinity for any of the Justice League characters, or is it just like the book to do?
Captain Atom, Power Girl, those are my two favorites in that book, yeah. I thought Wonder Woman was supposed to be a part of it, which I was excited about, but I guess I think Byrne was going to do a new Wonder Woman book, and he didn't want her in Justice League, so they pulled her.
I remember you did a cover for Wizard that ended up not getting used as a cover. That was just gorgeous of Wonder Woman.
Oh, thanks, yeah, she was kind of floating, jumping. Yep. Yeah, I did several for Wizard that they ended up never using as covers.
Bart Sears quit Justice League Europe to work on the Legends of the Dark Knight arc, Faith, and And that was sort of just an opportunity for him to work on a darker style. And then he went from that to the big Eclipse of the Darkness Within event. You remember that one?
Yes.
Did you read that?
That's one where all the heroes were being mind controlled, right?
Right. You get the Eclipse of Diamond, and if they got angry while they had one in their possession, they were eclipsed and controlled as puppets by Eclipso.
Okay.
And an interesting side note about that, too, is Bart Sears hit some deadline issues in that miniseries. There was only two extra-sized bookends, but he couldn't quite get the second one finished in time. And so the first instance of Keith Giffen drawing in his Trencher style, which he almost exclusively used for Trencher and one Lobo Infanticide miniseries, debuted on the Eclipso crossover. So we're already seeing a lot of imagey stuff happening related to Bart Sears here. So,
Sears, wow, that's cool.
Sears launched an Eclipso ongoing series out of the event, which didn't sell all that great. He only did the first three issues.
And then I left Justice League to do the Dark Knight, and then Eclipso, the Eclipso crossover, and then the Eclipso miniseries, and that's during that is when I left DC.
And then he turns up on, and I think this was probably more likely your introduction to Bart Sears, Turok number one.
Oh, Turok number one? Oh, yeah. I remember that. That had that cool hologram or that that steel cover, didn't it?
It was chromium.
Chromium, there you go.
But it was like, it was a chromium inset adhered to a cover that was embossed with dinosaurs forming a border around it.
Yeah.
Did you get that book when it came out?
Yes. So at that time, I was definitely reading Solar, Exo Manowar. Turok was one of my favorites. Archer and... what was his name?
Armstrong?
There you go. Archer and Armstrong. I read a little bit of that. Shadow Man, Hard Corps. What was the one with Harbinger and all them?
Harbinger?
The teen group. Harbinger? Was it Harbinger?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So I remember at the time where I was living, there was a comic shop that I had to walk. And I can say this now. Back in my day, I had to walk about 3 to 4 miles just to get to this damn comic shop. And the guy was really cool about putting those books aside for like new people. And I remember picking up all those books. And that's when Jim Lee was doing covers.
He did the Hardcore number one cover, I remember.
Which one?
He did the Hardcore number one cover because it had the gatefold.
Yeah. But I remember it was a big deal because everybody's like, oh, it's, you know, it's Valiant. You know, it's like picking up number one of Spider-Man type shit.
Yeah.
I remember a lot of speculation at the time.
Oh, yeah. Well, and speaking of that, okay, Turok number one was the number six best-selling comic of 1993 behind the Reign of the Superman launch issues. So like all four of the Reign of the Superman books and probably Adventure Superman number 500 as a combo were probably filling out the rest of the top books of 1993. For me personally, I always see Turok number one and Adventures of Superman number 500 as the bust, like the ground zero of the bust of the comic book industry. Because those were the two books that within shortly after they came out, you could see stacks of those things in comic shops being sold at a discount. And in particular, really? I remember going to a comic shop that was next to a liquor store where I would cash checks when I was doing door-to-door curb number painting with a couple of guys. They'd put me in their pickup truck. They drive me to a neighborhood. I canvass it, putting out paper solicitations on the doors to see who one of their curb numbers painted on. And then we would go and cash the checks that they would leave for us in the mailboxes. And there's the liquor store and the comic shop. And I remember that comic shop had a stack of Turok number ones they were selling for something like a quarter or maybe a dollar at a time when I think the original cover price is like $3. So within like a month, they were being sold for a dollar. So that's just, like when I knew shit was about to turn.
I just picture you like dressed up like Huckleberry Finn with no shoes and overalls and a straw hat walking up and down neighborhoods. Sir, would you like your curb sign, sir?
I can tell you that pretty much every pair of jeans I had back then had both knees blown out. I can guarantee you that.
A young Frank Huck.
I remember one lady said that I looked like Dwight Yoakam, and she meant it as a compliment.
So do you look like older Dwight Yoakam now?
It wasn't Sling Blade Dwight Yoakam. It was still, you know, when he used the hat to hide. I like Dwight Yoakam. He's a really good singer.
Yes, I just the other day listened to Bakersfield. Bakersfield. Yep. So I just picture you going up and down the streets like Huckleberry Finn.
There's actually a picture of me.
Oh my God, dude.
Me.
I'm having a fucking meltdown here.
Yeah. No, there's actually a picture of me in the back of one of those pickup trucks.
Oh my God, don't.
I've got it somewhere.
Don't, you bastards, because I'm going to have to go find it somewhere.
I've got it in one of my photo albums. I can probably dig that up for you.
Oh, dude, I want that on a t-shirt.
Well, and I had this like really weird t-shirt, like a Far Side looking t-shirt, like some like bootleg Far Side. I couldn't afford like Far Side merchandise. So it's like some bootleg shit from Walmart.
Please, please, please tell me you were wearing coveralls with one strap only. That would have been just pure perfect right there.
So Turok number one came out on April the 27th, 1993. That was the same month as Youngblood Strike File number one and Spawn number nine. Just to give you a sense of the timing on this. I thought it was a really good looking book, but Bart Sears only ended up doing the two issues.
Yeah, I vaguely remember that.
And that was the book that launched Rags Morales, who I also really liked.
I did not know that.
Which came first? Was it Turok or was it Violator?
It was Turok. Wait. No. It was Violet. It's Violator. Turok? Okay, Turok.
So I believe that was in like 93, 94, and I think for each, whichever years it was, I think Turok number one was one of the best-selling books of that year, and then I believe Violator was the highest unit sales for 1994. You only did two issues of each. How did that happen?
At Valiant, I had agreed to do Turok Monthly and Exo Monthly, which was one of the stupidest things I've ever done in my life. And when I realized I couldn't do it, I didn't come clean and tell them I couldn't do it. I tried to keep doing it and just fell further and further behind until they canned me.
Wow.
Which is a real fucking drag, because Violator number one was released.
Looked great.
Yeah, it was released on May the 16th, 1994, around the same time as Turok number 14 was out. So you can see the timeline is really fucked at this point. And then Spawn number 21 was also out. It was the top comic in unit sales for 1994, number one. It was the seventh ranking in dollar share. Number two came in at 46th in unit share. So what happens in this story?
Right at the beginning, we're introduced to the Violator's brothers, who are watching what's going on Earth do a portal.
Huh? They call it a black oracle, and basically what they do is they take humans that are in hell. I don't know if they're supposed to be their souls or their physical forms, but they crack them open and make a pool of blood, and they're able to scry into our world through their blood. But whenever the image starts to get hazy, they gotta go crack open another human and reinvigorate the black oracle.
And the reason they're doing that is they're watching their brother, the Violator, being carried off in his clown form by some mobsters and some cement shoes.
Yeah, it's worth noting that this was after Malbolgia cursed the clown to stay in human form. He could not become the Violator. This was after Spawn number four. He couldn't leave his human form.
Okay, so he's stuck in a clown form now.
Right.
So he doesn't have all his powers.
Right. And
actually,
he's
like depowered, right? He depowered him.
Just a dude. You know, he's got nothing.
I thought he had a little bit of power.
He's got the power of punching people.
No, well, because I'm okay. So, well, you'll see. So at this point, they're taking him onto a pier. They're going to throw him over. Tony Twist is talking to his, I'm assuming, a different. Who is Alberto?
Alberto, I think, is the guy who is basically his lieutenant, the guy who's doing all the Violator-related activities, who's heading that up, right?
Because I didn't know if he was like a bookkeeper or like what he was. But as they get Violator close to the edge to throw him off the pier, he lunges forward. He grabs one of the mobsters by the tie.
Or bites
as
the
he's
tie,
thrown,
right?
He's dragging them. As he's being lunged into the water, he's dragging the mobster with him.
Yeah, it's a bald
dude in shades.
They're
both sinking down. He's somehow able to break free of his binds on his hands. He reaches in. He grabs the mobster's gun, puts it in his mouth and blows off the back of his head. Wasn't this part of the toy where he's walking around with a head on his hand or something like that?
They did a version of the clown action figure where he's got a head stuck on his hand and kind of gets lodged onto his arm and will be on his arm for the rest of the miniseries.
And if you look real closely at the scene where the clown is swimming after he's blown off the cement blocks off his shoes, dude, those are some fucking massively muscular arms. That is definitely Bart Sears artwork right there.
Well, it's funny because he definitely puts a lot of effort into showing his gut as well. So he's definitely
Has muscles on top of muscles underneath muscles with a little muscle on the side.
Yeah, so what you're saying, he's the Bart Sears character.
Yes, most definitely. He looks demonic even in human form. Like, that would scare the shit out of me.
I gotta say right off the bat, I vastly, vastly prefer Bart Sears' version of the clown over Todd McFarlane's. He's still a force to be reckoned with when Bart Sears draws him.
Next thing we know, we're on the beach because they're trying to find their buddy who fell in the water. The guy is leaning up against a fence, screaming out to, or hollering out to his buddies. They come to check on him, and that's when the clown shoves his hand through his mouth and starts to shoot everybody.
Yeah, he's basically doing a Weekend in Birdies with the corpse. I forgot. It's not that he blows the head completely off in the water. It's that when he's puppeting the corpse to lure his buddies in to kill them, he's got the gun through the hole that he'd made while he was in the water, and that's when the head becomes completely severed from the body.
At this point, his brothers, who are in hell, see what's going on and decide they're going to go after him, because apparently he was the abusive brother. He's the oldest brother, right?
Indeed.
And so they kind of want to get back at him. They notice that he's still in a weak form, so I guess they're going to take a shot at him. They take a couple of humans to keep their portal going so they can see what else is going on. At this point, Tony Twist is introduced to Nuke.
Very Nuke-like from Daredevil, but it's actually
yes.
The Admonisher, a sort of amalgam of Punisher-type characters.
He definitely looks like Nuke, right?
If you had to pick one guy that he's an analog from, Nuke's a fair. He doesn't do the whole face paint
Nukem
thing.
Nukem as well.
Duke Nukem, sure, absolutely. I mean, he's a gigantic white dude with a crew cut and blonde hair.
He's showing off his talents to Tony Twist by murdering his guards in a nonchalant manner. Oh, they're showing the security footage of what the Violator looks like in his monster form and what he looks like in his clown form. And Tony Twist wants him taken care of.
He's one of those Drax kind of characters where he's way too literal. Tony Twist is just telling him that his buddies are going to show him pictures, Violator, but the Admonisher misunderstands and just kills two of Tony's men as a result. And then at one point, Tony's like, you know what Teddy Roosevelt said, tread softly and carry a big stick. Admonisher's like, you want me to kill this Roosevelt guy? It's kind of a running gag that this guy is very obtuse and very literal.
Why don't you go now?
Oh, but you're doing such a good job.
You asshole. Violator's brothers are watching him slowly as he's traveling. I mean, the artwork is just fantastic, dude. It's brutal.
Man, I love Bart Sears, and he's really on point with in this one. I mean, as we were talking about, not only is there muscle, but there's all these veins and cool perspectives, and he was getting very experimental because he'd spent so much time following Keith Giffen's layouts on Justice League Europe that he really wanted to show his own design aesthetic, and I think he was inspired by Todd McFarlane to try to design his pages so that each page was like a work of art unto itself and had these design elements that made every page. I mean, part of it was the secondary market. It's like, if you had a really good looking page, you could make more money off of it. But he really put a lot of thought into laying out his pages. And you've also got the cute little bit where you've got a Spawn eyes icon, like the one that Deadpool ripped off. They use that as a page counter, but they also have little Violators playing inside the counter as well. That was cute.
I never noticed that. Oh yeah, you're right. They do. Duke finds the Violator in a mall. What does he scream out?
I am the Admonisher, and I'm here to give you a darn good telling off.
Darn good telling off.
Yes. Well, admonish is to criticize somebody for doing something inappropriate. And so even though he's ultra violent, he speaks appropriately. He may scream, but he screams no expletives. He's just offering constructive criticism.
Okay. And they begin to battle. Again, looks great. I like the fact the Violator has that mobster's face on his hand, which I thought was pretty cool. Yeah.
Well, and also,
gave me a very commando feel when Arnold Schwarzenegger is hanging that guy over the edge and they're falling through the mall.
What's so great about it, too, is like I'm remembering the mall sequence from Youngblood number one. And really, you just see a few figures. It's all close-ups on the people that are fighting. Where here, you really get a sense of the mall. It's like you see all these patrons.
On this one, you actually get to see people in the mall.
And yeah, you absolutely have a great sense of the surroundings.
Well, and I just noticed right now that one guy actually gets hit in the head with the gun as it's going down
far right corner. Oh, yeah, man. Never, he's dead, too.
Never noticed that when I was reading it the first time. So they're battling, throwing people off the walkway as they're fighting. Duke is kicking, well, not really kicking Violator's ass. It's more Violator's just trying to run away. He definitely feels outmatched. But Duke is just flying like a ninja all over the place. I love the way he has that sword on his forearms. You know, it's just great design. It's just fucking insane looking design of weapons. At this point, the brothers are arguing over the humans that are left in their cage. Oh, no, they're complaining that if the human waste Violator, how it's going to make them all look bad to have one of their own killed by a human. They take a human, they rip it in half, and create a portal. Am I right on that, or
sort of a portal? I think it's safer to say that what they do is they basically bring hell to the mall. It's like they actually merge the mall that's in the human plane with hell so that it becomes adulterated and dark and twisted. And then Violator's brothers, who are the Fleabag brothers, I think that's how it's pronounced, they show up to confront their bro. And so it's five brothers in total, including the Violator. And this issue, I believe, is what introduces us to the other four brothers.
Yes. And of course, the design looks fantastic because they look similar enough where you could see the resemblance, but they're also very different at the same time.
Now, personality-wise, they're not that far apart because they're basically the Three Stooges, the Four Stooges, where you've got Shemp in the mix as well, making pratfalls and over-violent run-ins with one another and everything else. They're not the brightest of bulbs, clearly. clearly. Viola definitely is smarter than any of the lot of them. They do have little variances in personality and definitely in appearance. You can tell them apart.
Yeah. I especially like the big brother in the back, even though it is mentioned that Violator is the older brother of all of them.
Yeah.
That is the end of that issue. Next, we have Flesh.
That's it, Spawn. Let yourself go. Get pissed. Do some damage. Don't take shit from nobody. And oh yeah, the big boy downstairs. Because this is the way the world ends. Not with a bang, but with a lot of blood and torn flesh and broken bones. And I just love it.
We have the confrontation between Violator and his brothers, and we get a sense of who each one is, and I'll go into that in a little bit more detail in a moment. But basically, the brothers start manhandling Violator.
Now, this is
Violator
taking place during the hunt, right?
Yes, exactly. They're paralleling one another, because we get little references to what's happening with the clown in the Spawn issues. So Hell comes to Earth. There's a barrier that forms around the mall that prevents anybody from getting in. Youngblood has a cameo where they're trying to get in. Bedrock and Shaft specifically are shown. And fuck, man, I wish we'd gotten to see a Youngblood comic drawn by Bart Sears. That would have been so fun. Fucking badass. When they can't get through the barrier, one of them says, listen, don't tell Chapel about this, okay? So the five famous Filiac brothers are the Vindicator.
And for my sister, quit shoving. I was here first. Shut up! It's an ice cream, guys. Come on, let's go, let's go. Come on, move, move.
Fine, you guys, come on, come on. There he is.
Okay, what about creamsicles?
Hell has many demons in training. This one is known as Billy Kincaid.
And you may remember Vindicator as Little Jessica from Spawn number 8.
That's right.
That's the one who develops Billy Kincaid. This is the brother that's more of a sorcerer, and he's the one who has the fur-lined eyes.
Okay.
Then you've got Vandalizer. He's a little bit dumber than the rest. He's the more muscular, furry, bear-looking one. More mammalian and hairy. So he's the one who's doing most of the beating on Violator in the second issue.
Yeah, he's definitely the Mo.
The Mo?
Yeah. You said the Four Stooges earlier?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I can see that. Then you have Vaporizer. He's the biggest of the bunch, visibly larger than the rest, has a little bit more of a spider-like quality. He eats the Admonisher, and his GI track is ripped to shit by the same. Admonisher rips the fuck out of the guy to get out of him again. Then you have the Vacillator, who's probably the most annoying of the brothers. That's the one that has the cyclopium segmented unit eye, but looks more insect-like as far as the eyes goes. That's the one that is constantly being indecisive, debating, and never coming to a conclusion about anything.
Okay.
The Admonisher ends up blowing Vin's brains out, and that causes him some problems. That's when we get to the flashback, and we find out how the Violators came about. So Dr. John Dee, who is a real-life, I think a 16th century doctor, scientist, sorcerer, he summons what he refers to as a flea-botten spirit of the upper airs, or as translated by the clown, a blood-sucking fiend from hell. This creature is about 15 feet tall, with 100 teeth or more.
Very Cthulhu-like.
Yeah, more so than the rest, certainly. And so Dr. Dee feeds the appetites of this blood-sucking beast, which includes sanguine desires and also carnal. This creature likes to get his fuck on. They bring him comely lasses, whom he impregnates, and then these poor women do not survive the birthing of the individual Fleabag brothers. So they're all technically half-brothers, since none of them share a mother.
True.
And so Violator is the eldest half-brother. He commits patricide. He finally gets fed up with the dad, saying that the dad was always siding with the other brothers, even though Violator is actually pretty much always in the wrong, because he's a bully who's constantly attacking his brothers. So he kills his own dad, and then he's the one who raises his younger siblings, but he's essentially an abusive dad to his siblings, and that's part of why they hate him. Plus, they're all fiends from hell, so it's kind of being expected.
Dude, but you skipped over the cool part.
Like what?
When Violator is before Spawn, Elvis is there. So at the very end, the Violator is running away from his brothers. He's getting the shit kicked out of him. He falls into an alleyway. He runs into a bunch of homeless guys. One of them is definitely Elvis. They carry him off, and they take him before Spawn. The Elvis character says, "So sorry to interrupt, boss, but this here fella said he wanted to see you. Tell me if I'm wrong."
Oh, well, he's definitely Elvis. Yeah, no doubt that he's drawing Elvis there.
I thought that was cool.
I did miss another cool part, though. So when we were doing the origin sequence, Violator was telling his origin story to the decapitated head that stuck on his arm while the Admonisher was fighting his brothers and distracting them. And he gets so sick of the head being stuck on his arm, he tries to pulverize the head, and instead he ends up breaking all of his fingers.
Yeah, I remember that.
I think one of the homeless guys is Nixon, too, isn't it?
Is it?
I'm thinking maybe.
No. I mean, it's definitely Elvis.
Oh, no, Howard Hughes. One of them is Jack Howard Kirby? Hughes. The one with all the hair, the crazy-eyed one with all the hair, yeah. That's supposed to be Howard Hughes.
I was thinking the one on the far left looked kind of like Jack Kirby a little bit.
I'm not feeling that.
No? Okay.
Plus, he had already died by then. I don't think they'd do that.
Elvis had died at this time, asshole.
No. I'm fucking Jack Kirby.
Oh.
Like, I think that wound was a little fresh. Now, I will say...
I
do have
too
to
close
say,
to home?
Yeah, maybe home. So. I do have to say this, too. The splash of Spawn on the last page, I don't really like Bart Sears' Spawn. It's too bulky.
But that's how he draws everybody, dude.
Yeah,
everyone is like
I think
exaggeratedly strong.
He looks a little better lanky.
Yeah, you know what? I agree with you. Yeah, more of a corpsey look to him, thinned out. I don't like when he's all muscular.
Yeah, too much meat.
You know what? Someone should draw that. Like a really thin Spawn with more cape. Like the cape is the bulk of his body.
Uh-huh. Actually, J. Scott Campbell did a few covers recently, and he does do a really skinny Spawn.
Okay. You know what? I never thought about that. That's something I would be interested in seeing, like a super skinny Spawn. Because, again, he is a zombie, technically.
Yeah, it's rotting meat. Yeah. How do you keep a muscle tone when you're dead?
Yeah, because, I mean, that's just too much muscle, dude.
But I will say this. In the Greg Capullo drawn third issue, he draws a ripped Spawn, and it I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm used to seeing Capullo's Spawn. I don't know. But it just works better when Capullo does a beefy Spawn versus when Bart Sears did it. For me personally. When I look at Bart Sears' Spawn, he just doesn't look right. He does a great fucking clown, but man, I so love the way he did those Youngblood characters. I was just looking at it again. If he'd done a Shaft miniseries, I might give a fuck about Shaft.
Yeah.
Such sweet folks, those homeless. They will take anybody in, including a freak like you, Spawn. Hey, maybe you'll meet a nice homeless woman and raise a bunch of homeless kids. Wouldn't that just be king?
What the hell do you want?
Right to the point. I like that, I really do. Because it's not what the hell do I want, it's what does hell want to do.
You're about 2 seconds from wearing that smile around your ass.
Yeah. Kiss me first, all right?
You're a hell spawn.
The earth is ready to burn. You're the guy with the match. And I'm here to make sure you do the job right. You should be down on your knees thanking Malbolgia for the privilege of being a ranking officer in this hell's army.
You should be down on your knees thanking me for not killing you where you stand.
Yeah, right. I don't think you know who you're dealing with, but it's time you found out.
Listen, fat boy, I've had just about enough.
Yeah, baby. Woo! Right there. That's how Daddy likes it. You'll feel some pain.
What are you?
A creature far superior to humans. A true native of hell. Something no spawn will ever be. Consider this a friendly reminder. Get with the fucking program. You spawn. Never been worthy.
Issue number 2 came out on June 13th, 1994. So 2 month gap between issues 1 and 2. That came out around the same time as Spawn number 22. Then issue number 3 comes out July 18th, 1994. So only a month later. But this issue is drawn by Greg Capullo.
And I was burnt out by the time I started Violator. And I got through issue 1 and started to... And it took forever. And, I got through issue 2 in about 5 weeks, but in the meantime, Todd had hired somebody else to do issue 3.
But also Bart Sears had gone off to form Ominous Press. If you remember in Wizard Magazine, he had a monthly column where he taught people how to draw. And it was called Brute and Babe. The male figure would always be Brute. The female would always be Babe. And they kind of look like Silver Surfer and Nova with energy hair and shit.
Yes.
And so they also are going to be like star characters in this Ominous Press Universal Comics. Did you ever read any of those?
No.
How did you end up forming Ominous Press?
That was all thanks to Turok. I used the money I made from Turok to create my own company, and we were doing a lot of toy design. I constantly did Toy Biz toy designs, and I hired people to help out with that stuff, and then they screwed me out of that after I built the company to do it. But anyhow, so we transferred into comics, which we started too late and just behind the eight ball, and it just... I was dying, I was dead, so I folded it all.
He had this idea. What they were going to do is basically, rather than having a comic book that was stapled, they were going to be tablets. And so each page was almost like a large trading card, and you could actually like rearrange the pages however you like. But it was a costly experiment, and it was not well received. And of course, the bust was happening by that point. The bust is starting in 93, and things really started to collapse in 94, which was the same year Ominous was getting launched. Ominous was definitely the right word for it.
Now, you're bringing Ominous back, though, over at IDW these days. Is that correct?
Yeah, we started about maybe more than four years ago. I got together with some of the guys I worked with at Ominous back in the day, and we decided to give it a new launch. So we've been grinding at it for the last 4 years.
Greg Capullo's artwork is great. So are we on the third issue now?
Yeah, we're on the third issue, but that is one thing I do have to say is I'm looking at the third issue, and I like Capullo, don't get me wrong, and I like Capullo in this period, but following Bart Sears does not do him any favors, man.
You've lost that big muscular clown. The clown doesn't look the same.
Your styles are just so incompatible, man.
Spawn is way too much. I mean, dude, he has like a 12-pack or 15-pack.
I kind of like it when Capullo does it, though. It just doesn't look right when Bart Sears does it. I think he's just too rubbery looking, too, and the rubbery thing is something I actually like about Sears for most of his characters, especially when he's doing shiny superhero type characters like a Power Girl or a Superman. But yeah, for Spawn, shiny Spawn doesn't work. Spawn's kind of dirty, smelly. He needs to be roughed up a little bit more.
He needs to look like Ragman.
A little bit, yeah. I like Ragman. Yeah, I can see that. I never drew that parallel, but yeah, it makes fucking sense. Yeah.
There's certain characters, when I look at them, I picture what Spawn would be like, and that's Ragman, maybe Sleepwalker from Marvel. Just those weird kind of characters in capes, I guess.
Yeah, and the cowl action there too. Yeah. I think Sleepwalker steals from Spectre, and Spawn is a bit of Spectre debt. So
yes,
with the third issue, sales plummeted outside the top 300.
So it dropped that fast?
But that's top 300 of the year. So it's not like, I'm sure the month that it came out, it did well enough. But you're talking about the number one comic book of 1994 for the first issue. And by the last issue, it's not even the top 300 for the year.
Violator basically talks Spawn into juicing him up.
Well, it's important to note, too, that Violator is the only person, to my recollection, that actually manages to escape from the mall somehow. He manages to get through the barrier and get to Spawn. Either that, or the barrier is big enough to where it includes Spawn Alley. I'm not sure.
I think so. I think it's the alley's trapped inside the portal or the barrier.
And if I remember correctly, isn't Tony Twist and the fellow you were telling?
They were still trapped in there as well.
They're stuck inside,
And so, of course, the clown, always the manipulator, is able to manipulate Spawn into juicing him up.
Well, what he's saying is that if Spawn basically unlocks his power chastity belt, whatever you would call it, the power lockdown that Malbolgia applied to him, then the pair of them could work together to defeat these demons.
And Spawn is foolish enough to believe it. Now, in this part, did the clown drain Spawn?
I think that the amount of energy it took to unlock Malbolgia's curse on Clown wiped out Spawn temporarily, where he didn't have any juice.
Yeah, and I thought that was kind of cute, where, you know, Spawn is in his weakened state, and he's like, "Hey, didn't you forget something?" And he goes, "Oh yeah, sure." And he walks over and just kicks the shit out of him.
Didn't he kick him off a roof or something? Weren't they on like a rooftop? And Violator walks up to the weakened Spawn and just kicks him off the side of it.
Yeah, basically kicks him. Yeah, and kind of wham moment for Spawn. Spawn's not looking great in this one.
At this point, we've well established that Al Simmons is not the smartest guy around.
True,
he's not fucking the Dark Knight detective. That's okay. He kicks all kinds of ass. He's a bad motherfucker.
That's true. He's not a tactician. Duke is beating the shit or shooting the shit out of the Violator brother. At which point, I think they're even scared of him.
He's definitely dealing some fucking serious damage, given that these guys are supposed to be demons from hell and everything.
Yeah, and they're not unable to kill a simple human.
Once the Violator is back into full power in his demon form, he fucks up his brothers as badly as he can, which is pretty bad. And then he goes after Tony Twist because he's tired of his bullshit. But Tony Twist had his buddy Alberto with him, who looks enough like him that he's able to con Violator into thinking Alberto was Tony Twist. And so Alberto ends up being drawn into hell with the Blebeak brothers and Admonisher. They're all basically stranded in hell by the end of the story.
But you forgot the part where Duke actually jumps through the portal because he's not done with the brothers yet.
He's still got some admonishing to do.
Yeah. It's funny because you see the brothers running the portal, actually scared of this human who's firing. He's jumping in hell. And in one of the books, don't they even have him running around hell shooting people still?
We'll get to that.
Okay. I do like Greg Capullo's chapel, though.
I do like his Vandalizer.
Even his Bad Rock looks cool.
Yeah, Vandalizer. I do think Greg Capullo has a nice Vandalizer. That's the mammalian one. The one who gets his fucking arm bitten off by Violator, and then I think his heart gets ripped out or some shit.
Yeah. Well, he fucks up all his brothers, but yeah, he fucks him up the worst.
Oh yeah, that's the thing too. Violator gets a hold of Alberto thinking it's Tony Twist, and then he puts a clown mask on Alberto and basically makes him look like the clown, and that's the reason why Alberto ends up getting dragged to hell with the Fleabag brothers.
Yes, because they think they got the clown. That last scene of the Violator is a pretty cool scene. Last panel.
Oh, we see too, we as you said, Capullo draws Chapel, and they do ultimately tell Chapel what happened. So Chapel is apparently still associated with Youngblood at this point, which doesn't make a ton of sense. I don't think that's correct, but it is kind of cool to see Capullo do Chapel, since that doesn't happen very often.
But am I looking at it right? Is that his skull and not makeup? Because at this point, he'd already melted his face, right?
Yes. He definitely draws him in the J. Lee mold, where he's got the fucking fangs and shit, and like no lips, it seems like.
But you would have figured his nose would be gone.
Yeah, he's still got the nose, which is weird. It just doesn't quite work.
And of course, Spawn is passed out in the alleyway, depowered, slowly recharging. The Violator makes his triumphant scream in the air that he's back.
All right, so Spawn Maniacs this month include 108 Sage, Adriano, All the Pouches, and Image Comics Podcast, who noted that we are two shows here to satisfy your image yearnings, Dr. Ange, Between the Pages, Christopher Bush, Coffee and Comics, DeBache, Delvin, Derek William Crabb of Fanholes Podcast and History of Comics on Film, who was our guest and noted, Derek is on his favorite podcast about Spawn and Image this week. Check it out. Ed Moore, El Romero Romero, Eric Borden, Estupor Profundo, Gene Hendricks of the Hammer Strikes, Random Geeky Stuff, Giant Foam Decat, Guido, not Guido, as he points out in his little brackets, Harmless Entertainment, Iowa's Joe Crawford, Jason Snicked Venable, Jeffrey Brown, Keith G. Baker, King Size Comics, Giant Size Fun Podcast, Mike at Send Aliens to Me, Mike Peacock, Odell Abner Dracula, Pat Sampson, Professor Frenzy, Resurrections and Adam Warlock and Thanos Podcast, Richard G., Roger Preeb, Ryan Daly Serves the Murder Hornet Queen, Savage Fincast Podcast, Schlockipus Inc., Scott Paladin, he, him, Secret Wars and Beyond Podcast, Siskoid, Tim Price Podcast, Crasher, and Xanadu. By the way, did you see that video of the murder hornet being killed by the praying mantis?
No, I saw the one where the bees killed it. The murder hornet follows a bee into its hive. It kills like one, and what the bees do is they surround it, and they generate heat, and they basically cook it alive.
Ooh.
There's a 2-degree difference between the bee and the hornet, and that 2 degrees is enough to cook the hornet, and they just swarm it. Hmm. And the whole time, the hornet's trying to get away, and they're just piling on, and they're, I believe they're vibrating, mm-hmm. or they're buzzing to the point where they're generating heat, and then they move away and you see the wasp and it's just curled up in a ball where it basically was cooked alive.
Cool.
The Japanese bees have evolved to learn this technique, mm-hmm. to defend themselves, where American honeybees are got this foreign invader going to fuck them up real fast. So,
well, what the praying mantis does is it does this whole Zen thing, and then it reaches out with its long arms and grabs the murder hornet, and it just starts leisurely eating its fucking head off. I've got a strong stomach and everything, but it just started to disturb me how chill the mantis was as it's eating, starting at the eyeball, thing is still alive for a good length of the time, and just eats it down to a nub.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I know they said in Japan, they actually eat them, like they fry them or cook them, mm-hmm. kind of like grasshoppers, but there's supposedly a certain liquor where they'll put one in the liquor and the venom enhances the alcohol. You drink it, it's supposed to fuck you up even more because the venom is in the alcohol.
I gotta tell you, I tried a fair amount of alcohol laws in Japan. Japanese alcohol is the worst shit. Yeah, they have awful taste. Everything is super dry, super bitter, and just fucking gross. When they tell me mixing Murder Hornet, I have no confidence. Superman has definitely killed some guys before, aka John Wilson wrote, "Hey Spawnometer, I saw this and thought, man, if that were Spawn instead of Dragon surrounded by Image characters, it'd be great for your show. Someone in fan art land should make that."
Oh yeah.
Now, are you familiar with that one?
Cool Savage Dragon.
Yeah. That was used for what they called Image Illustrated. It was a Hero Illustrated special about Image Comics. I used to have it. I don't think I have it anymore. And then apparently, according to this, they also made it a 2-page spread pinup in Savage Dragon number 15.
Mm-hmm.
And what I said is, look, Savage Dragon is the superhero comic with the longest tenure by the same creator. So I'm perfectly happy with him being the one at the center rather than Spawn. And really, we need to get some more Savage Dragon out. It's just that because Spawn ties into Rob Liefeld stuff so closely that I have to do a lot of Liefeld stuff. And, you know, at some point that'll taper off. But I do like Savage. He's definitely one of the granddaddies of Image, and I think he deserves being the guy at the center of the Image this time around.
No, definitely. I mean, I've been meaning to revisit some of the books because it's been so long since I've read it. Yeah, he's definitely the granddaddy.
Like we did last time with Supreme, I'm still trying to find some folks to take care of some of the areas that you aren't into, because I know you'd be down for doing Savage Dragon, but I like you being there for at least the first installment of any given properties, because I like to get your opinions on it, your experiences with it, and then maybe move on to other folk. But at some point, I'm going to start looking for some volunteers to see who wants to talk about the next volume of Brigade or some shit like that I know you got no fucking interest in. So Jeffrey Brown wrote, and I'm going to do some editing here, bear with me. So now you are reading the issues of Image Comics I didn't get to read at the time, namely Spawn's story arc about Terry getting framed in season 2 of Spawn. I rewatch it sometimes mostly because of how Chapel plays into Wynn's plot and the clown. Also, I never liked Woods art, and he's a piece of shit these days, along with a few other ex-Extreme talents. Terrible people. I never followed much of the early Supreme comics, and I really came around when Alan Moore started writing the character. And then Jeffrey came back with a video noting, I am just letting you know that he's not a nice guy, and that he said some things I am sure you wouldn't appreciate. And then another fellow came in and said that this person is a great dude. What the hell are you talking about? He is a stand-up guy who just wants to share his art and help other people learn, and a tremendous artist. So I want to address this here in an episode where it's not necessarily relevant, just so I can be as cryptic as possible.
Okay.
This creator came to Texas a few years ago. I got a piece of art from this creator, and I got a brief interview with him. It was funny because you and I were at the show, and as I'm interviewing this person, I had my phone on, and I had that Uvula thingy with like snake rattle whenever text would come in, you know?
Yeah.
And so you and Max started texting each other while you were off doing something else at the con. And so while I'm trying to interview this person, bear with us, okay?
You talking to me?
Yeah, I was taking advantage of having him solo for just a minute. Although you are relevant. So you...
Of course I am. What a fucking ridiculous thing. Go ahead.
So in the midst of doing this interview, you and Mac were texting each other, and so my shit was going off constantly because you're going back and forth joking with each other, and the dude was like, what the fuck's going on? What is that noise? You know, and I had to explain to him what the hell's going on. And so I got an interview with this person because I knew at some point this person would be relevant to the podcast, the material we're going to cover. But in recent weeks, this person has come out to be a member of a group that I am obviously strongly opposed to, because as you know, I am a cuck, soy boy, whatever you want to call me. My politics are unambiguous. Anybody who listens to the show knows my politics. I am aware that there are people who listen to the show that are on the other side of the aisle and would probably want to come to this creator's defense. This creator, when they were interviewed by me, it was a good faith arrangement. They're assuming that, you know, I'm coming at them from the correct place, that I'm there as a fan or somebody who wants to support their work, and that I'm sure that motivates them to contribute. I don't feel comfortable, as a matter of good faith, just like not running that material. I do think that there are people that would like to listen to that material. I did some vetting too to see if there's anything specific that this creator had said that I would have like a strong moral opposition to, and would just be like, okay, no, I'm just not going to run it. I don't give a shit. Fuck it. I could not find that. It's not a great association. Under any other circumstance, I would be perfectly happy to talk about how much I am opposed to this group, but it's not fair to that creator just by association to trash this person. I don't think it's fair to trash the interview. So basically what we're going to do is, on the episode where it's relevant, we're going to do like we do with Marvel superheroes. Usually Spawnometer doesn't have any kind of stinger, but in this instance, we're going to have some bonus material where it's going to be the complete unedited recording. All I'm going to do is level it. I'm not going to edit it in any way because I don't want anybody to fucking come at me like I did anything weird. And it's not like there's anything controversial in the conversation anyway. It's strictly talking about the comics. But I don't want people that would not appreciate hearing from this person or anybody associated with this movement having to tolerate listening to something that they're opposed to. It is relevant to the material we're going to cover. It's back matter. If you don't like it, you don't have to listen to it. You can just stop the podcast before it comes up. And that's all I want to say about it, because it's not fair to go after somebody in absentia. It's not fair to go after somebody when they're not in a position to defend themselves. I don't want to have some kind of bullshit engagement. I'm not interested in that kind of bullshit. I'm not going to promote it on that episode. I'm not going to promote the involvement in the episode. It's just going to be there as a little special something for the people who are actually interested in it, and then not deal with that shit anymore. I'm just not interested. I don't want to engage. I don't see the value in engaging with it. So it's just going to be there.
Can I talk now?
Sure, go for it.
Yeah, I saw that one dude got all mad about it, and then somebody replied to him and was like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, so I was very confused.
This is a person who comments pretty regularly on our shows. Good person. Obviously, I'm going to side with a person that supports our shit and talks to us over a rando. He's promoting all of his Indiegogo bullshit, kind of a stan of his. And so if I could find him doing the fucked up shit, I'd say fuck it. But I can't find that. There'd be me playing into the stereotype. It's censorship.
I would not run the interview. I think you're probably making the right decision here. If you want to put it on the back so people can easily avoid it if they don't want to hear it, that's fine. But
it's only like 5 minutes and shit, too. It's nothing major or anything. It's not like I'm platforming him and he's going to talk about
stans. I guess we have stans probably too. Does everybody have a stan?
I don't think we got anybody hard. Stan is like the Eminem song. They are not like next level. I don't think we have anybody that's that hard for us.
Oh my God. We live in bizarre times.
So the final comment comes from Odell Abner Dracula, who just sent a picture of Logs on a Fire saying, drinking alone, burning shit, listening to Spawnometer, which I think is a perfectly valid way to enjoy And because a bunch of people randomly decided they were going to like his tweet, I'm going to drag them into our shit. And the Living's Easy, Beppo, Chris Dunford, Danielle Smith, Filthburger, I Am a Horrible Goose, Jim Kersey, The Ledgerman, Lisa at Footnotes, Lisa Dimmers, Missy, Mass, Not Very Spicy Shrimp, Otha, Zachariah, Edward, Los, Robum, Steve Dave, and Sue Kent Ant.
Make sure you check out the JLI podcast.
The JLI Bwahaha podcast.
Hi, Spart Sears. Make sure you check out the JLI Bwahaha podcast. You want to make something of it?
Justice League International Bwahaha podcast. A new monthly show chronicling the adventures of the JLI era by Keith Giffen and J.M. DeMatteis. We'll be going issue by issue in release order, tackling the core Justice League title, Justice League Europe, and the quarterly book. Along the way, we'll take time out for special episodes covering various spin-offs, cartoon appearances, the infamous TV pilot, and much more. So join me in an ever-changing roster of guest hosts as we celebrate your favorite JLI members, such as
Martian Manhunter,
Batman,
Dr. Fate,
Black Canary,
Fire,
Ice,
Maxwell Lord,
Oberon,
Captain Marvel,
Rocket Red,
Captain Atom,
Mr. Miracle,
Guy Gardner,
Booster Gold,
Blue Beetle,
Nort,
and many, many more. Justice League International, Bwahaha Podcast, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Want to make something of it?
And this isn't really your thing, but any word on the Dreadstar book that was going to come through Ominous?
As far as I know, they're still talking about it, so hopefully that'll be announced soon.
Last year, several of your favorite podcasts and blogs got together to cover one of the greatest comic events ever, DC's 1993 annual crossover, Bloodlines. But it wasn't enough for them to just cover your newest favorites, like Nightblade, Jam, and Shadowstrike. They wanted to do more. This year, they are. In celebration of its 25th anniversary, they will be covering DC's 1992 annual event, Eclipso, The Darkness Within. Join Coffee and Comics, DC Bloodlines, Between the Pages, Pop Culture Palace, Relatively Geeky, Cosmic Treadmill, For the Non-Discerning Reader, Resurrections, and Adam Warlock and Thanos Podcast, Chris on Infinite Earths, The Retroist, Diana Prince Wonder Woman, and On the Gun, and learn who gets possessed, who fights back, who will be canceled, who will die, and who will get their own spinoff. Keep up with the crossover using hashtag BestEventEver and hashtag Eclipso TDW25 all throughout June 2017. Beware the power of the Black Diamond.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure, man. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Stop and listen. Stop and listen to me. Listen. Listen. Listen to me. They're not human. Everyone, they're here already. You're next.
November 4th, 1988. Earth is invaded by an alien alliance composed of several species, including the Dominators, the Kuns, the Tanagarians, and the Durlans. And they want our superheroes. Even though Australia has been decimated, the United Nations response is unequivocal. Drop dead. First Strike, the Invasion podcast, takes you back to that moment in time and covers the entire Invasion DC Comics crossover. Issue by issue, tie-in by tie-in, join Bass and Siskoid at fireandwaterpodcast.com or on iTunes. First Strike, the Invasion podcast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Remember, number.
This is a fan-produced, not-for-profit podcast. No copyright infringement is intended, and any use of copyrighted materials believed to be covered under fair use. If you don't agree, you can go straight to hell!
So for Ethan Van Sciver was a fucking star. That guy just went full Randy Quaid is what happened to him. That guy could have just kept on working and kept his fucking mouth shut, and he'd still be one of the biggest guys. He's literally like one of the only guys in the
post. Who are you talking to?
He's talking to me.
Oh. Yeah, I've been on hold like the whole time. I was like, I guess
it's okay because I was just talking at you anyway.